Karen Russell isn't wasting any time making a name for herself in the literary world. Her debut novel, Swamplandia, was a finalist for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Russell was named a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree in 2009 for her first short story collection. Now she's released her second collection of short stories, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Anne Strange Champs talks with Karen Russell.
Karen, the short stories in this new collection, I read one description of them as the perfect blend of magic and reality. How does that description strike you?
Oh my goodness. The bar is high if you're saying perfect blend, right? I do like that. I like that it's some kind of Starbucks blend of magic and reality. I always feel a little uncomfortable, I guess, talking now, which I've been doing sort of a lot of yakking about fantasy and reality, like I believe they're binaries. You know, like I think that they're two discrete categories. I've sort of always been drawn as a reader to fiction where it's happening on a continuum, right? It gets really slippery. Whatever distinction between the real world and the imaginary one, it gets effaced. And I grew up in South Florida, right? I think the last time I was on the show, I was talking about Florida, which is like a magical realist state.
Really? I was going to say, a lot of people would think of that as the least magical place in America.
Well, that's probably true, too. But I think it was such a good instruction for a would-be fiction writer because you have all of these invented places, you know, theme parks, tiny diorama universes. In principle, anyway, Florida's big industry is fantasy. And then you have just the real strangeness of the geography, the ocean, the Everglades, and also just people living their real lives in this kind of surreal place. So I'm sure that whenever I talk about sort of fantasy and reality, I think about just my childhood home where it was anybody's guess where one line ended and the other began.
So you don't just write magical realism, you grew up in magical realism.
Every time people ask about magical realism and Marquez and the Latin Americans, I sort of think, yeah, there's a literary influence, but also it was just growing up where the parrot jungle was next to the grocery store, you know.
I read somewhere you described this kind of writing as an optical trick that lets you see something that you might not be aware of if you were reading about the same plot set in a mall in New Jersey.
Right.
What did you mean?
I'm glad I said that. That sounds right. Sometimes you get less flattering echoes back from interviews. It does feel a little bit like an optical trick because I think if you can set up the ratio of supernatural details to naturalistic details correctly, it's not that you're writing about a completely other realm. I sort of think of it as like a funhouse mirror. Flannery O'Connor has that fabulous quote, "For the blind, you draw large and startling figures." I must be a little myopic just in the world because I'm sort of drawn to writing these exaggerated, monstrously distorted versions of reality. But I think sometimes you can see a little more clearly, you know, some aspect of just the everyday gets dilated so you can see it. So, you know, with the title story, these vampires, sort of as a ridiculous premise there. The least sexy vampires in the world, this monogamous couple that are living in a lemon grove, they've discovered that they don't need to drink the blood to survive, but they do have this bottomless craving. They're still pretty afflicted, and they found that a temporary fix is to shove a lemon on their fang. So that's sort of an insane premise, but it was a way for me to think about kind of a pretty universal predicament, right? When you discover that there's some myth that you don't have to hew to, but you continue to have a certain craving or some problematic recurring desire that's making your relationship difficult. So I guess that's a very long-winded answer to say often there's some way in which these stories, as kind of outrageous as the premises might seem, it lets me think about a pretty basic, pretty human question or problem.
That story, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, it's both magical and very realistic. Could you read a bit for us from that story?
Oh, definitely. Over the years, Maghreb and I have tried everything. Fangs in apples, fangs in rubber balls. We have lived everywhere. Tunis, Laos, Cincinnati, Salamanca. We spent our honeymoon hopping continents, hunting liquid chimeras. Mint tea in Fez. Coconut slurries in Oahu. Jet black coffee in Bogota. Jackal's milk in Dakar, cherry coke floats in rural Alabama, 1,000 beverages purported to have magical quenching properties. We went thirsty in every region of the globe before finding our oasis here in the blue boot of Italy at this dead nun's lemonade stand. It's only these lemons that give us any relief. When we first landed in Sorrento, I was skeptical. The pitcher of lemonade we ordered looked cloudy and adulterated. Sugar clumped at the bottom. I took a gulp, and a whole small lemon lodged in my mouth. There is no word sufficiently lovely for that first taste, the first feeling of my fangs in that lemon. It was bracingly sour with a delicate hint of ocean salt. After an initial prickling, a sort of chemical effervescence along my gums, a soothing blankness traveled from the tip of each fang to my fevered brain. These lemons are a vampire's analgesic. If you have been thirsty for a long time, if you have been suffering, then the absence of those two feelings, however brief, becomes a kind of heaven. I breathed deeply through my nostrils. My throbbing fangs were still. By daybreak, the numbness had begun to wear off. These lemons relieve our thirst without ending it, like a drink we can hold in our mouths but never swallow. Eventually, the original hunger returns. I have tried to be very good, very correct and conscientious about not confusing this original hunger with the thing I feel for Maghreb.
I have to confess, I'm a novel reader. I actually don't read a lot of short stories. I feel like I'm confessing that I'm not a very good reader, but I find them dissatisfying because just as I get attached to the characters, the whole thing's done. What do you think? What's good about a short story?
Yeah, I think a lot of readers have that experience. It's a different pleasure, right? I mean, I think a novel, there's something wonderful about being with characters over time. And I think some readers, if they're going to commit to a fictional universe, it's a lot of work. It's asking a lot more of readers than nonfiction. You have to assemble this entire imaginary world, right? You're not reading about crime in Detroit necessarily. You're reading about, you know, in the case of Saunders, some alternate world where Semplica girls are possible or escape from Spiderhead, or in this case where I'm asking everybody to imagine a lemon grove of recovering married vampires. So it's a lot of work for readers. It's a big ante. And I think some people, they just want the sustained pleasure of a novel to put down stakes there. But I also think there are many people who haven't read a short story since they were forced to in high school, since they had to read like the yellow wallpaper and write about its themes in a 15-minute block for some test. And the experience of reading a story collection as an adult is an amazing one. I mean, I didn't know that I liked stories until I went to college and was given Flannery O'Connor, Juno Diaz. And it is, it's true. The ending is going to feel maybe necessarily abrupt because you just met these people, you know, you just got oriented to their world and what, it's all over. But I think it can work in the best cases the way a joke or a poem does, where there's such a powerful impact. The thing is so compact, it's so kind of turbocharged. You can read it in one sitting. You can have this sort of seamless experience of it. So I hear you, Anne. I know a lot of people who are primarily novel people, but I like to advocate for the short story because it's its own special monster. It's sort of a beautiful form. I think it can infect readers in the best way. You can then be haunted by the ending in the best way, too, because it's not resolved in the same way a novel sometimes is.
Boy, that is such a natural segue into the second story in this book, which I have to say did stay with me for a very long time. And word to readers, don't read this one before bed. This is the one about the girls who sort of turn into silkworms.
Yeah, that is probably the most upsetting one in some ways.
What happens in it?
I loved writing that story. That felt like such a kind of new territory for me, I think. It was upsetting for me, too. There's some really uncomfortable stuff in this one. It's set during Meiji era Japan. The sort of historical bedrock for it is just there was this period of incredibly rapid industrialization where Japan is going from this isolated feudal nation to sort of its modern form. So the entire island is kind of shuddering with the velocity of this change. And then in a micro way, I was reading about the story of these daughters of tenant farmers who went to work as silk reelers in these new Western-style textile mills. So basically Western-style factories, and they were promised a really pretty glamorous and well-compensated life as sort of cotton spinners, silk reelers. In many cases, the actual history is pretty devastating. They are working 10-hour shifts and terrible conditions. And it was funny because reading this, it's not like you can dismiss it as some antiquated human rights violation. I think it has a lot of contemporary resonances for impoverished workers everywhere. So anyway, this is a very long windup, but the story ended up being about these daughters of farmers who are duped into going to work at a place called Nowhere Mill, a really nightmarish factory, and transformed into actual silkworms. So they're kind of compulsively producing silk.
But it's much more physical, more visceral than that. They drink this tea, or they're forced to drink this tea, and then it's as though the insides of their bodies sort of liquefy and turn into silk.
Yeah. It's a digestive horror story, right? There's a sort of a reproductive horror story in some ways, too, because they're gestating. They're like literally gestating the silk. And then they have to hook up to this machine to sort of, I don't know. I mean, it's so gross to talk about it.
You wrote it.
I know. Every time I read the jacket copy, it's so disorienting. I'm like, I did write that. How frightening.
Is there a bit of it you could read for us?
Yeah, let me do maybe just the, I'll put it bluntly paragraph, because that's sort of how gross it becomes. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll put it bluntly. We are all becoming reelers. Some kind of hybrid creature, part Kaiko silkworm caterpillar and part human female. Some of the older workers' faces are already quite covered with a coarse white fur, but my face and thighs stayed smooth for 20 days. In fact, I've only just begun to grow the white hair on my belly. During my first nights and days in this silk reeling factory, I was always shaking. I have never been a hysterical person, and so at first I misread these tremors as mere mood. I was in the clutches of a giddy sort of terror, I thought. Then the roiling feeling became solid. It was the thread, a color purling invisibly in my belly. Silk. Yards and yards of thin color would soon be extracted from me by the machine.
That's so hideous and beautiful all at the same time. And you know what's so effective about that is that it is both fantastical and grounded at the same time. And the details are so concrete. Is that a very deliberate choice you make, kind of a way of making, I guess, the supernatural real?
You know, I do think so. And I think I've learned so much, or must, you know, by osmosis, because this was the stuff I love to read. People like Frank Herbert and Dune, or, you know, Calvino and Borges, or Kafka, certainly. So The Metamorphosis is such a great example of precise physical detail. I mean, it's scary and funny and a range of emotions when Gregor Samsa wakes up in that insect body. And I think, you know, he doesn't stop there. I mean, he's imagining, how would this really feel? What do his little legs look like twittering out of the corner of his new bug eyes? What does it feel like to have a hard shell back? What are you going to do when you're both worried that you're going to be late for work and you can't roll over on your exoskeleton and climb out of bed because you're a cockroach? So I was reading stuff where there's no switch and register. It's very matter of fact. The table and the bed and the picture frame are described in the same kind of detail as Gregor Samsa's new mandibles. For me, too, I think it wasn't such a stretch to sort of imagine, literally imagine, and to make concrete this silk growing inside these girls. In this story, it's really connected sort of to their memories and their emotional worlds. I think a lot of people have that, right, where an emotion feels like a concrete entity. It feels material, you know, like grief can feel like a rock in your gut. So it is. I just think it's sort of a natural way for me to think about the materiality of emotions in the past, too, just the weight they can carry.
So I was thinking that this theme we've been talking about that's kind of running through here about the mutability of stories, but also about that transformation from the imaginary into concrete physical reality. I was thinking, of course, it's such a perfect theme for a writer, because that's what you do, right? When you're sitting down in front of a piece of paper, you're taking the imaginary world that's in your head and making it concrete.
Right, hopefully, and in such collaboration with readers, sometimes I think it's almost like all we're doing is writing a score, and then whatever happens inside the reader's brain is some completely private symphony. You know, there's something so spooky and amazing about that to me. You know, now, having gotten to meet some readers, and you realize how different whatever world they assembled, you know, out of those words might look or feel.
It's almost like the readers are the ghosts.
Yeah, a little bit. That's like not an attractive metaphor, but I do think it's this way. You want to virally inhabit this other person's body. You want to make a good delivery system. the work that, yeah, a fiction writer is doing. That makes it sound kind of malevolent to say a virus, but, you know, maybe like music, right? It's on a page that somebody else is going to embody.
We welcome your imaginary ghosts inside our heads.
Thanks, Anne.
Karen Russell is the author of the short story collection Vampires in the Lemon Grove. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. And we have just enough time to hear Karen Russell read an excerpt from another one of her stories. This one's called The New Veterans. It's about a massage therapist named Beverly who discovers she has the power to heal by manipulating a war veteran's tattoos.
At 3:45, Beverly begins to wind down. She makes a few last long strokes along his spine's meridian. Time's up, she's about to say, when she notices something stuck beneath her pinky. When she moves her hand, she slides the thing across the sky on Zeiger's shoulder, still tethered to her finger like a refrigerator magnet. Only it's flat. It's inside the tattoo. No, she thinks, impossible, as she continues to float it around his upper back, an orange circle no larger than a grocery sale sticker. It's the sun. Beverly swallows hard and blinks as if that might correct the problem. She draws her pinky halfway down his spine, and the sun moves with it. When she lifts her little finger, the sun stays put. She can't stop touching it, like an idiot child at a stovetop. Well, this is trouble. This is a real madhouse puzzle. The sun slides around, but the rest of the tattoo stays frozen. The cows stare at the grass, unalarmed, as it zings comet-like over their horns. The soldiers' faces remain stiffly turned to the west, war blasé, as the sun grazes their helmets. She gasps, just once, and Sergeant Zeiger says in a polite voice, "Thank you, ma'am. That feels nice." "Time is up," Ed raps at the door. "Bev, you got a 4:00.
Karen Russell, with an excerpt from The New Veterans, a story from her new collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove.